Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, on the heels of the Texas anti-abortion law, what are the implications for women's reproductive rights? Is it the end of women's rights to reproductive choice established by Roe v. Wade? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Recently, Texas has passed a law that outlawed abortion after roughly 6 weeks, as part of what they call a fetal heartbeat bill. Despite a precedent that ensures abortion access through at least the first trimester of a pregnancy, the U.S. Supreme Court did not overturn this law. This has culminated a series of cases intended to overturn a woman's reproductive right to access to abortion as enshrined in the landmark U.S. Supreme Court case, Roe v. Wade. On today's show, we will examine the law, the unique form of enforcement, and what this means politically and sociologically for women's reproductive rights and privacy. Our guests are Rachel Rebochet. She's the interim dean of Temple University Beasley School of Law and the James E. Beasley Professor of Law. She's the co-author of Eugenic Abortions and the Problematic Popularity of the Reason-Based Ban, What the Public Gets Wrong About Reason-Based Abortion Bans. Lena Marie Murillo, assistant professor at the University of Iowa. She is the author of an upcoming book, Fighting for Control, Power, Reproductive Care, and Race in the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands. Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He holds the Matt Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership and Global Affairs, and is the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. And Sanford Levinson, W. St. John Garwood Jr. Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas Law School. He's the author of Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It. Thank you all very much for joining us today on this important issue. And Rachel Rebochet, let's start with you. What exactly is this law and what does it do for women's reproductive rights?
So it's a so-called heartbeat bill, and it's, as a statute, not new text. It's part of a series of bills that circulated state legislatures and were passed by some, and then we're enjoined by the courts for being an unconstitutional infringement on the right to abortion because they apply before viability, which is the point at which roughly 20 to 24 weeks where a fetus can live outside the womb. And that's a line that you referenced in your introduction set by the Supreme Court in a case called Casey that follows Roe that said you can't ban abortion before viability. That's, I'm sure we're going to talk about, going to be a question the court thinks about during this term. So the law itself has been enjoined by other courts. And what makes this law different is the enforcement mechanism. So instead of the state of Texas banning abortion and having its courts apply that law in the sense that we would for most bans, as they do for the 20-week ban in Texas, you can be prosecuted as a provider by the state if you violate other abortion restrictions. State officials can't touch it. They are not allowed to enforce the act, which invokes a doctrine we can talk more about that is an exception to sovereign immunity. If you are trying to prevent state officials from enforcing unconstitutional laws, but there's no state official here to sue, as some courts have said, because it's private citizens that enforce the law. Citizens who can sue providers who have violated the law for money damages of $10,000 per abortion committed in violation, and citizens who sue other, not only providers, but those who aid and abet the violation of the law. So the question I think that this group is probably eager to discuss is just how different this enforcement mechanism is, what are its implications for other areas, and how it's been at the key, at the center of the litigation in state courts now and in federal court. I'm excited to talk about last week's lawsuit by the DOJ against Texas, that petition and the petition filed this week for to move up the the hearing for the TRO, the temporary restraining order. It's just great. It's such an interesting brief. What does it mean for reproductive rights? This is not good. This is not good. I mean, it's not good for the women in Texas who aren't going to be, or who are not receiving abortions past 6 weeks, which is a point at which many women do not know, or many people, I should say, do not know they are pregnant. And there's already well documented travel and influx into Mexico and Oklahoma and neighboring states of people who have to leave the state in order to receive an abortion.
And Lena Marie Morello, I know you've been working on issues about access to reproductive rights, particularly in this area of the country. Can you give us a little bit of the background as to some of these struggles, some of these challenges, and what this means for these issues?
Absolutely. So before this law went into effect in Texas, there were already sort of major reproductive care deserts. And, you know, no pun intended, but El Paso, Texas was one of those places. So since about as early as, I believe, 2013, there were some gaps in access to care. And then in the last year or two, like really when the pandemic hit, all of their major abortion clinics closed. So they were already dealing with the sort of travel that Rachel was talking about earlier. So you have clinics in places like New Mexico, in particular in Albuquerque, became a major hub. And then traveling across the border to Ciudad Juarez, which is literally the major bridge that connects El Paso, connects it to Ciudad Juarez in Chihuahua. And right when you cross the bridge from Juarez to Chihuahua to the main drag, you will see dozens of pharmacies ready to provide abortion medication to people. You know, and as a historian, I study the sort of longer legacy of the history before Roe, when people were going to places like Tijuana and Ciudad Juarez to obtain abortion care, which was quite prominent in the late 1940s, 50s. And then there was sort of an apex of the use of transborder networks to access abortion in the 1960s. So in some ways, we're sort of returning to these older networks that existed in the years, the decades before Roe.
And Jeremy Suri, one of my questions is, what's going on in Texas with all of this? That I know there's numerous states that have filed these challenges, these cases that are intended to invite the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade or to have severe restrictions. But this Texas law seems to be pretty unique. Is there anything sort of unique about Texas or the way that this issue has arisen out of the state that makes this a bit of an outlier?
Well, there are a lot of things that are unique about Texas, some uniquely good, some uniquely bad. So that's a broad question. It's a good question, though, because it allows us to tell a little of the political history of this law. And I think the politics around it are fascinating. So by every measure, the majority of the citizens of Texas support a woman's right to choose, particularly early on in a pregnancy, and particularly in cases of rape, incest, and things of that sort. So this law does not fit with the consensus, if one were defining a Democratic consensus in the state of Texas. And all signs are that the consensus is moving more and more toward a women's right to choose. If you look at urban voters, Texas has four of the 11 largest cities in the U.S., two of the fastest growing, including Austin. And these cities are becoming more and more progressive, and that's where the new voters are. The politics around this bill represent a concerted effort by a relatively small group of very conservative lawyers and some religious leaders, but it's mostly lawyers, and I'm sure Sandy can comment on their legal capabilities more than I can. But they have been moving for years to try to create legal mechanisms for denying what is both the consensus in the state and what is the law of the Constitution, which is a woman's right to choose. And so there have been more than a decade of efforts to restrict activities by Planned Parenthood, to restrict access to abortions in various settings. El Paso has been an area that's been attacked in particular along these lines. And this was a very creative way reacting to recent Supreme Court jurisprudence, which opened the door for this kind of what I consider as a historian vigilante justice, to get around the restrictions on state limitations on abortion by creating, in essence, citizen posse limitations. And as a historian, this echoes a different Texas tradition, unfortunately, that takes us back to the long story of lynching, which is extrajurisdictional efforts encouraged by the state or by the community or county for citizens to do things that state law enforcement cannot officially do, but that they want citizens to do for a particular political reason. And that's the space that we're in right now. I don't believe that this political framework will last very long because the politics are moving in a different direction. But in the short term, when you have a Republican governor who's being challenged on the right by even more right-wing Republicans, and he's looking to firm up his credentials as the Trumpiest of the governors in the country, this is a useful position for him to take, a position he would not have taken in earlier years. And so you have the conjunction of minoritarian politics, interest group action, and a governor who's looking to tack to the right for the short term. And that's produced this combustion that we've had.
And Sanford Levinson, Sandy, I've been wrestling with this question. It's unconstitutional to restrict a woman's right, her access to an abortion through the first trimester. So Texas passes a law, acknowledges it's unconstitutional, by then saying, here's a law the state won't enforce. And so somehow the law gets enforced that way. I've been wrestling with a logic. I've been scratching my head about how this works. Could you explain try to explain how this works?
Not very well, because nobody knows. No suits have been filed. And there are vigorous debates going on that get into various esoteric areas of constitutional law, especially the so-called state action doctrine. I mean, it seems to me that once you file a lawsuit and expect a court to act, the state is acting, and all of this nonsense about the state not getting involved is nonsense, but who knows? What I really want to say is that I think this conversation will have a very short shelf life. That is to say, if, as I suspect is the case, the court is going to overrule Roe versus Wade sometime this term, I would be not shocked, but I would be mildly surprised if you didn't have 5 votes simply to overrule Roe rather than to do what Chief Justice Roberts clearly wants to do, which is to strangle Roe without, in fact, overruling it. I don't think he'll necessarily be in control of this court. So then we really ought to be thinking about what next. And so let me be slightly apocalyptic and suggest that we're in 1858. Up to 2 years ago, I would have said, well, abortion is a really divisive issue, but it's nowhere near comparable to the struggle over slavery at the end of the 1850s. I no longer think that's the case, because I think that politically, both sides have become maximalist in terms of their public articulation. That is, what Texas exemplifies is pro-life maximalism. Life begins at conception. The stuff about 6 weeks is clearly a distraction. The people supporting this believe that life begins at conception, period. I suspect that is Amy Barrett's view. So that is one maximalist position. If that is your view, and if you view all abortion as murder, what is there to compromise about? The Democratic Party's leadership, on the other hand, has adopted the position, which I personally support as a matter of political preference, of reproductive rights maximalism. That is to say, if you believe in the autonomy of women, then women have a right to choose to terminate a pregnancy at any point. You know, we could, if you want to, but I think it'd be unproductive, get into so-called late-term abortions. But it certainly covers all abortions without exception for the first two trimesters. If that's your position, again, it's hard to see how one compromises in an ordinary political sense. It's not a matter of money. You want a billion, I want 500 million. We're going to end up somewhere around $750 million and go on. Ironically or not, the Supreme Court, in an extraordinarily clumsy, rather incoherent way, has stumbled on a compromise that most of the country actually agrees with. The problem is that it is quite likely that there are five members of the Supreme Court that either disagree with the compromise per se, because they really are militant Catholic anti-abortionists. And for these purposes, I will include Neil Gorsuch, who is nominally an Episcopalian, or because they really and truly believe that that Roe was wrong in declaring that reproductive rights were a matter of constitutional protection at all. One last point, and then I'll stop. Justice Scalia, who clearly believed Roe was wrong, was a public partisan of the so-called federal solution. You know, if New York wants to legalize abortion, fine. If California wants to legalize it, fine. But if Utah and Texas want to criminalize it, that's also fine. This is actually what the so-called federal solution was to slavery. That if Texas wanted to be a slave state, fine. If New York wanted to be a free state, fine. That solution obviously turned out to be unstable. The House divided itself, could not stand. I don't think today there is majority support among the political class, if you will, for Scalia's federal solution. I think, as I've already said, that the anti-abortion people have really adopted maximalism and would view Scalia as a squish. And I think that for whatever reasons, which we might want to talk about, the political decision makers in the Democratic Party are now committed to a single national solution that will protect women. And I don't see a way out of this. We know what happened in 1860. I am quite fearful of what is in our future as Americans.
Well, listen to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the legal implications and the political implications of the recent Texas anti-abortion law with Rachel Rebuchet of Temple University, Lena Maria Murillo of University of Iowa, Jeremy Suri of the University of Texas, Austin, and Sanford Levinson of the University of Texas School of Law. Jeremy, sir, you had a response.
Yeah, just quickly to push back a little bit on my colleague's comments. I agree with some of what Sandy said, but I, as a historian, I want to offer a different point of comparison, which I think might be useful for our discussion going forward. I don't think we're in 1858. I think we're in 1870. And perhaps just because I finished a book on 1870 a few days ago, maybe that's why I'm thinking about 1870. But here's why. In 1858, as we all know, the country really was divided on the issue of slavery, and for very good reason. For a large proportion of Southern Americans, as well as many New Yorkers and others, their wealth was tied to slavery. We're in a different place today. All evidence is that American opinion is moving in the direction of maybe not a maximalist position as Sandy defined it, but of a pro-choice, pro-reproductive rights position. And those of us who teach undergraduates see this every day. So the country is moving in what would have been an abolitionist direction in 1858, which it wasn't moving in then, it is today. What we're witnessing is not a divided country. We're witnessing a hijacking of democracy by a small minority group, even in the states where they're doing that. So the policy pursued in Texas is not popular in Texas, even. It is only popular with an extreme group within the Republican Party. And then there are other Republicans who will go along with it. That's why I think we're in 1870 right now. And that's why my diagnosis is slightly different from Sandy's. I think the solution for this is not compromise in the middle. I think the solution is pushing harder for reproductive rights and pushing harder to have the voices heard of more Americans. I would tie our discussion today to our discussion of voter suppression. The only way these kinds of laws remain in place is if you have continued voter suppression. The court can decide whatever the court wants to decide. It is up to the American public to make a decision as to how we perceive the basic rights of citizenship. And I think our opinion is moving in the right direction. We just have to make more of an effort to protect the expression of those opinions in our political system. The court is not the place for that to happen.
Rachel Roche, you wanted to respond as well.
You know, I had a similar reaction to the comment that Democrats are reproductive rights maximalists in the sense that I actually think Democrats are pretty comfortable with the undue burden, middle ground compromise. And lots of them are very willing to say there should be some consideration to limitations on abortions for various points in pregnancy or for various reasons or for funding purposes. I mean, a big fight between Democrats and Republicans, and Democrats conceded, was whether or not the federal government or any government had to pay for abortions outside of rape, incest, and life. And that's changing. And so I think that that reflects Jeremy's point about the changing kind of social acceptance and other cultural valence of support for reproductive rights. But I also agree with Sandy that we're seeing this really interesting moment that thinking in a post-Roe world, first of all, what does that mean when a lot of the country already lives in a post-Roe world, to Lena Maria's point? You know, people in the Rio Grande Valley do not have access to abortion. So what does Roe mean for them unless they cross borders? And so that's kind of where I'm going with Sandy's point about what's next. If the Supreme Court decides pre-viability abortion bans are constitutional, they can do that wholesale by overturning Roe / Casey, or they could take the route of just saying, well, you know, undue burden, we reinterpret Casey, and it always meant that viability was one line, but not the line. And so viability is not the line in the sand for constitutional or unconstitutional ban. They'll gut Roe, and, you know, overnight in many places, trigger laws and other bans or other laws that are on books will make almost all abortion illegal. And so then you have the federal government as the intervener. I mean, what's so astonishing about the DOJ case is the Biden administration acting through DOJ really doing what it said it would do. And up to this point, there had just been a lot of rhetoric about, you know, we really love reproductive rights, really for women, really for autonomy, you know, yay, 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 in speeches that never mentioned the word abortion. And then bam. This Texas law galvanizes the federal government to start thinking about it as the protector in the absence of constitutional protection, or with the specter of a court decision that overrules Roe, or states passing laws like SB 8.
Can I say two things?
Please, Eddie.
One, if the Supreme Court overrules Roe, which I think we're all presupposing for aspects of this conversation, then Congress will have to decide on a single national policy. One of the things that Roe has allowed now for 50 years or 48 years is that both the Democratic and Republican Party, for quite different reasons, can dodge the issue by saying, well, the court will decide. I mean, from my perspective, Roe has been in certain ways a continuing gift to the Republican Party. because they've been able to demagogue on the issue of being pro-life and passing a whole bunch of statutes that they knew that courts would strike down so that suburban women would still vote Republican and would just say, oh, they just shout that way at abortion, but we don't have to take it seriously. Democrats, I agree with you, Democrats privately might well agree with something relatively close to the clumsy Supreme Court doctrine. But if we, or not we, because I'm not a Democratic leader, if we are asked to take a public position, then as a matter of fact, it's pretty hard to offer a truly rational defense of where the Supreme Court has come out. Kind of all you can do is to say, well, because of these shifting coalitions of votes, they've come out with this undue burden stuff, and they've decided that this is an undue burden, but that isn't. But if you ask me, as I said before, for my own views on policy, I would be pretty much of a maximalist. But the difficulty is, you know, how do you negotiate in public and get votes in Congress for a solution that will be very hard to defend with your base in public? The other point with Jeremy, I am obsessed with the war and Reconstruction. In fact, I had to leave a conversation at 4:58 Eastern time to come to this one, but that conversation was precisely this. For me, 1870 evokes the Ku Klux Klan, and the fact that you have a lot of extraordinarily alienated people from the American political system, and there's no good reason to believe that they are completely and collectively going to accept the hegemony of secular liberals. Secondly, 1870 was followed by 1877, or you know, whatever date you wish to choose, in which the deal was made to sell out African Americans in order to achieve white unity. Now, you know, obviously the analogies are imperfect, but I do tend to be something of a Chicken Little these days, that the sky may be falling.
So I'm Lina Murillo, since I'm the only one that hasn't invoked the 19th century, I'll go ahead and do that too. Because it is a pivotal time for abortion, right? This is when you see state by state beginning to criminalize abortion. And oftentimes historians have cited the sort of professionalization of doctors and physicians at this time, and they sort of coalesce around this issue of abortion. But of course, white supremacy is also critical to this issue. At the end of the 1890s and into the 20th century, you see calls railing against race suicide, and the fact that you see massive drops in the birth rates, especially among white middle-class women. And so various historians have suggested, right, this is what helps sort of create and push for laws, essentially ending abortion. At the time, people abided by the quickening doctrine. So once you felt fetal movement, probably at the end of the first trimester into the second trimester, it was considered taboo. But up to that point, midwives and people knew how to, as they would say, return the menses, right? So this was not an issue until the end of the 19th century. However, even with laws banning abortion, abortion continued, right? And so I guess this is to the point that others have been making, what to make of people in the US who might need an abortion if Roe is struck down. Just as a note to all those who are listening, abortion will never go away. It is part of reproductive health care. And people will find ways around these laws, just as they did in the early 20th century. They will do so again. And one of those has been traveling to places like Mexico, which, right? A few days after Texas had the law go into effect on September 1st, a few days later, the Supreme Court of Mexico decriminalized abortion across the country. Now, there are certain states in Mexico that continue to have laws on the books that suggest that they will take people to trial in places like Chihuahua, the state right across the border from El Paso. Since 2015, they have, I think, about 10 or 15 people that they've prosecuted for alleged abortions. But you can get abortion medications. And I know of many organizations that are working in Mexico with US organizations to provide and continue to provide that care. So I think when we talk about a post-Roe world, we can look to history for how people acted to support themselves and support access to abortion.
And Rachel Robichaud, we've been talking quite a bit about a post-Roe world, but before the break, you had referenced that we kind of already are living in a post-Roe world, or at least there's a lot of areas that certainly are post-Roe. So how much is this law just bringing to the forefront legal campaigns to overturn Roe? And what's really just happened here is a lot of people are paying much closer attention to what legal scholars have known has been going on actually for quite a number of years.
You know, I think not just legal scholars, but probably more predominantly public health scholars, scholars of history, of sociology. You know, the University of Texas has TexPEP, a really fantastic center that focuses in on what does abortion access look like on the ground, and with wonderful researchers across disciplines working there. And I think that, you know, Lina Maria said it earlier in the program, and I couldn't agree more, there are these abortion deserts where there are not services. Services are hundreds of miles away, and to reach them exacts cost of travel, of childcare, of time off work, costs that many cannot afford. And so, and then add in immigration and age and race and, right. So you get the idea. And I think what's interesting about our conversation about Mexico decriminalizing abortion and people crossing borders is the role that medication abortion is going to play both interstate and intercountry. Because one of the things that's happening at the same time that there's a fervor for anti-abortion legislation in roughly half the country's state houses, that we are revisiting the federal regulation of medication abortion. So during the pandemic, and I'll be brief, but I get super excited to talk about it because it's so interesting where this is gonna go. You know, medication abortion is regulated by the FDA as any drug, and it's subject to a really strict safety protocol, or REMS, and it requires in-person dispensation. You can't get it at a pharmacy. It can't be mailed to you. And it requires providers to be certified, among other things. And during the pandemic, a court said, we're going to lift that restriction that people have to personally pick up the first drug of a two-drug regimen. And that suspension is still in place. And what's happened is the flourishing of virtual clinics in this country in states where telemedicine for abortion is legal, which is roughly over half the states. And so once you put medication abortion in the mail and mail it to someone, you know, pills can move pretty quickly and easily. It's affordable, and this is early in pregnancy. It's before 11 weeks, 10 weeks. It's, you know, they're real downsides to telehealth. I only suggest it not to advocate for the, you know, the bulletproof nature of a telehealth solution, but just to say abortion care is changing and how people access abortion services changed. And so, you know, we're living in a post-Roe country where there are going to be lots of hurdles, many obstacles to lots of people who will suffer as a response to laws criminalizing abortion. And to Lena Maria's point, but abortion is going to happen in these workarounds or in states that become epicenters of abortion care where it's legal and promoted.
And Lena Maria, you wanted to follow up on that as well.
I did, just very quickly. So Texas is sort of following up SB 8 with SB 4, which is to regulate, if not completely outlaw, right, the use of medication abortion, the shipping of medication abortion. So they know, right, that this has been a major workaround for people, especially during the pandemic. And while people, especially middle-class folks, might be able to sort of cobble the money together to go to places like Juarez or to travel to states like California or New York, right, where there are still clinics, these kinds of laws specifically, right, are meant to continue to marginalize poor communities and communities of color who already have all sorts of other healthcare deserts, right? So oftentimes we think of abortion as this critical issue, but places like Planned Parenthood provide all sorts of other services for communities, right? So when a Planned Parenthood closes or when a clinic closes, a reproductive care clinic closes, it's not just that they're losing abortions, they're losing a slew of other services, right? And so again, to the point of white supremacy in Texas, the fact that this is an assault on communities of color in a state that is, its demographics are rapidly shifting, right? To Jeremy's point about voting rights at this exact same time. That is the point, right? The point is to attack these very vulnerable communities. And it reminds me of Jonathan Wenzel's book, Dying of Whiteness, where he's looking at these spaces and these very Republican states that have essentially gutted out their healthcare system with the sort of, with the support of poor whites in these states because of xenophobia, because of racism. And so I think that, you know, all of these conversations around slavery, around white supremacy are central to the issue of reproductive justice, right? So not just rights, but the human right to have bodily autonomy is very much, I think, at stake in Texas.
So Jeremy, what's the possibility that this blows up in the face of, for the advocates for the law, especially if it's being framed as an issue of, you know, a question of access, question of class, of race, some of the different variables that Lena Marie just highlighted?
So I want to underline many of the points Lena Marie just made. There's no way to look at this and not see white supremacy behind it. And it has come out at every statement made by the defenders of this law. Most recently, the governor was asked what to do about women who are raped and in a situation where they now can't get an abortion. They don't find out until it's too late. They've exceeded the limited period in the law. And he said something very interesting. He said, "We're against rape in this state. We're going to get all the rapists off the street." It was clear that the governor was referring to African-Americans on the street who he imagines as rapists, when we all know that the vast majority of rapes are committed by people who the victim knows. The case of the sexual molestation of gymnasts within our own Olympic committee is the example of how this actually occurs. And so there's an image of people of color as criminals and people of color who should be targeted. And there's an effort by the state, I think, to make them out as the enemy through all of these activities. And this is an old, old story, not just in Texas, right? Throughout our country, which is why we've been talking about the 19th century. Now, where I disagree a little bit with some of what's been said is I actually think that this moment opens the door for change. I don't think this is closing the door for change. I think this is a clarifying moment. And I find myself in rare agreement with the new Wall Street Journal editorial page, which was harshly critical of the Texas law along these lines. For a long time, Roe allowed that you could make the claim on the right that you really were not anti-women and you were not anti-people of color, that you just simply supported some reasonable position. The unreasonableness of this is so startling and so galvanizing that my belief, coming to your question, Doug, is that this actually opens the door for more mobilization, for more reproductive rights, and for more, shall we say, progressive policymaking in a state like Texas than I've ever seen before. So many moderately inclined younger women and younger people of color who might not have been involved in the political system, might have avoided what they saw as polarized politics now have more of a stake in the game than ever before. And here's the way I think about it and the way the historical record would play out. Those who support restricting abortion are already mobilized. Those who take the maximalist position on the other side that Sandy describes are already mobilized. What about all those in the middle? What about all those moderately inclined, and they could be Democrats or Republicans or independent fathers and mothers who have a daughter, as I do, who's 18 years old and just gone off to college, and look at these issues and are now mobilized to change the law, to reverse this as never before. One of my friends who's very religious said to me, my wife and I, we're pro-life, but we're anti-cruelty. And now this has made the pro-life position cruel. I think in the long run, not even in the long run, I think in the immediate term, really, that mobilizes more progressive politics. There's still a lot of work to be done, but I actually think this opens the door for more change rather than less.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the Texas abortion law, the future of Roe v. Wade, future of reproductive rights, with Rachel Webershaw of Temple University, Lena Maria Murillo of the University of Iowa, Jeremy Suri, University of Texas, Austin, and Sanford Levinson of the University of Texas Law School. Jeremy Suri is going to have to drop off in just a moment. But Sandy, this now raises kind of an interesting issue for me, because now we've got this description of the way in which abortion can be provided in ways that are much more decentralized, the ability to be able to gain access to medication that will allow for a pharmacy-based abortion has increased, and the possibility of a backlash against this law that Jeremy has highlighted. But your description was one of a Supreme Court that might be inclined to take a national approach as a way to undercut, you know, some of these campaigns that are making abortion more available despite laws. Is this a case where you've got a court that really has a pretty big disconnect with the general population and the possibility that they could just outlaw abortion irrespective of what public opinion might be?
I don't think there are 5 votes in the court to outlaw abortion. I do think there are 5 votes to say that it should, quote, be resolved politically, unquote. And then the question, will it be resolved politically state by state or a single national solution? And I think that the present politics are such that there will be a huge temptation to look for a single national solution. I want to say 2 things, though. Although intersectionality does teach us that it's always important to recognize the issue of race, I think that with abortion, first and foremost, is that the debate is about women and the rights of women. To put it in the crudest possible way, I think that most white supremacists would be delighted with a higher abortion rate among racial and ethnic minorities. It really doesn't compute why they would particularly be pro-life if the issue really were restricted to minorities. What was mentioned earlier was some of the literature at the turn of the 20th century about the declining birth weight rate of whites. So, you know, you can squeeze in the race issue that way. But I think this is all about the control of women's bodies by largely males who are scared to death for all sorts of reasons about female autonomy. And that, you know, I think that's the central struggle. Secondly, I have found the discussion about new technological developments absolutely fascinating, riveting, because I didn't know about them. But again, let me put it within the context of 1857. Mississippi barred the importation of abolitionist male, M-A-I-L, because it was viewed as insurrectionary and states had the right to block this. Now, as a matter of constitutional law, I don't think Texas on its own could bar the importation of medicine from New York. That would violate the Commerce Clause. But if my surmise is that this is going to be nationalized, then if the national government is taken over by what I regard as a basically fascist Republican Party at present, where part of the fascism is male dominance run riot, then could the national government bar the use of the mails for the interstate shipment of an anti-life drug? And as a constitutional lawyer, I suspect the answer is yes, because to say that Congress couldn't presupposes that there's something special about protecting female autonomy. But if the whole debate is whether female autonomy is in fact protected by the United States Constitution, then it has ramifications going all the way down.
Lena Moreira, you have a response.
Yes, I'll just quickly respond to Sandy's point about white supremacy and abortion currently. This was a huge issue with the headlines that came out about the census and the fact that this is one of those moments where white decline was so stark. And white nationalists and white supremacists are beginning to create bonds between the pro-life movement. And this is something that I'm working on, a paper that I'm working on currently. And so for them, it's not necessarily, as Sandy said, in the crudest terms, I agree with you that they don't care what happens to women of color, whether or not they have access to abortion or not. They just don't care about that demographic at all. The demographic they are concerned with are white women who still can avail themselves of these services. And given, I mean, this was in the headlines for weeks in late August, the fact that U.S. white share of population is declining rang alarm bells for white nationalists across the country. And so we will begin to see stronger ties between these groups and anti-abortion movements across the United States to do exactly what they're doing in Texas.
One of the variables that needs to be talked about is the militance of the Catholic Church on this issue, because in Texas, one of the embarrassing political realities is that there are a whole bunch of Hispanics in the Rio Grande Valley who are not politically progressive on this political issue. And you can posit a number of explanations for that, but certainly one of the explanations is that especially women still tend to take Catholicism very seriously. There might be other reasons why men would be, you know, pro-life. And this is a reality where, you know, the Pope himself has to intervene in order to prevent American bishops from refusing to give communion to Joe Biden or to any other politician who adopts anything other than a maximalist pro-life position. That was not the reality of the American Catholic Church even 10 years ago, though certainly the Catholic Church has always been in the vanguard of the opposition against Roe. But I think you have seen a radicalization of major elements of the leadership of the Catholic Church. Amy Barrett represents a wing of Catholicism that I think 10 years ago would have been viewed as a sect and not something that is indicative of contemporary American Catholicism. I don't think that's true anymore.
And Lena Moreira, you want to respond?
Yes, I think that when we see two countries like Ireland and Mexico, who are overwhelmingly mm-hmm. Catholic, right, switch their positions on abortion, and mind you, there are still a lot of issues in Mexico because of exactly what Sandy was saying, right, that the Catholic Church's position on contraception and abortion. But I also want to suggest that we need to pay closer attention to evangelicals.
Yes,
they have been central, right? Like the Catholic Church has been there since day one, but in the years after Roe, it was really white evangelicals specifically who got in the fray to produce the sort of moral majority that allowed Reagan to become president in the 1980s, right? That's when we see issues around abortion becoming central to politics. And since then, no other conservative president, no other Republican president has been able to gain the presidency without coming out against abortion. And this is part of the mobilization of that era. And so I think that when we talk about religion, I certainly think that we need to talk about the sort of connections between white evangelicals and the anti-abortion movement.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely right. Tom Edsel had a terrific column in last week's New York Times online, where he suggested, to slightly oversimplify, that the leaders of the American far right in the 1970s, who realized that simply running on a program of white supremacy would probably be a loser, cleverly realized that abortion could become their entry point. And so one of the things that Edsel did was simply to quote the Southern Baptist platform, so to speak, around 1976, which today reads as wildly liberal as against the current position of the Southern Baptist Church. So I agree completely that one has to include largely white Christian evangelicals in any analysis, but I still wouldn't discount the remaining influence that the Catholic Church has in the United States over certain relevant parts of the population.
And Rachel Robichaud, I'm going to give you the last word about the future of Roe v. Wade, future of abortion rights. Where are we going?
That's weighty. Well, no, I'm delighted. It turns out I was quoted in that article because I have a more optimist. I push back against Tom Edsel to say that we're thinking about very complicated identities, politics, movements, parties. You know, race and reproduction and religion have been co-travelers, but they have flickered and changed, you know, at various points. You can think of a dozen examples just off the top of your head, not least population control in the 50s and 60s. Now, changing polls that suggest that people are not necessarily where they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago in their feelings about morality, religion, and abortion. And so, you know, it's a complicated picture. And I'll go back to just something Jeremy said. I do think there is mobilization. Maybe I don't have quite the optimism he has that states like Texas will post-Roe find abortion in their hearts and, you know, legislate to legalize. But I do think it's a long game. And I do think that SB 8 shows that you can galvanize and mobilize people on the back of a law that suggests, as Sandy did, this kind of vigilante justice. And what does it mean to have states thumb their nose at the United States government and pass laws that are clearly unconstitutional, even if you disagree with rights? What does that say about the nature of what people will do to ban abortion? Is it worth it? Could it be worth it? And how could it be worth it in the face of so much suffering that's resulted on the back of the law? So I am hopeful that there's mobilization, even without Roe v. Wade, that changes the discourse in this country.
Yeah, this clarion call for mobilization is a wonderful place to end this conversation. I'm reminded by a Republican friend of mine that the party should probably be wary of the dog catching this, this car they've been chasing, because they may find that it's going to spin out of their control. So with that, we've been discussing the Texas abortion law, the future of Roe v. Wade, abortion access and future contemporary and future advancements in access to abortion. Our panel today has been Rachel Robichaud, the interim dean of Temple University's Beasley School of Law and the James E. Beasley Professor of Law, and co-author of Eugenic Abortions and the Problematic Popularity of Reason-Based Ban, But the Public Gets Wrong About Reason-Based Abortion Bans. Lena Marie Murillo, assistant professor at the University of Iowa, and the author of an upcoming book, Fighting for Control, Power, Reproductive Care, and Race in the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands. Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, and the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. And Sanford Levinson, W. St. John Garwood Jr. Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas Law School. He's the author of Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong, and How We the People Can Correct It. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker, host, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.